roles, but also for his usefulness as an omen of disaster to come in original productions. Sometimes the Pocked Man puppet is merely displayed against the backdrop to cast an ominous note to a scene. Among the six duchies, he is a universal symbol. It is said the root of his legend reaches back to the first peopling of the duchies, not the conquering by the far-seer out-islanders, but the most ancient settling of the place by earlier immigrants. Even the out-islanders have a version of the most basic legend. It is a warning story of the wrath of El, the sea god, at being forsaken. When the sea was young, El, the first elder, believed in the people of the islands. To that folk he gave his sea, and with it all that swam within it, and all lands it touched, for their own. For many years the folk were grateful. They fished the sea, lived on its shores wherever they would, and raided any others who dared to take up abode where El had given them rain. Others who dared to sail their sea were the rightful prey of the folk as well. The folk prospered and grew tough and strong, for El's sea winnowed them. Their lives were harsh and dangerous, but it made their boys grow to strong men, and their maids fearless women at hearth or on deck. The folk respected El, and to that elder they offered their praises, and only by him did they curse. And El took pride in his folk. But in El's generosity, he blessed his folk too well. Not enough of them died in the harsh winters, and the storms he sent were too mild to conquer their seamanship. So the folk grew in number. So grew also their herds and flocks. In fat years, weak children did not die but grew, and stayed at home, and put land to the plough to feed the swollen flocks and herds and other weaklings like themselves. The soil grubbers did not praise El for his strong winds and raiding currents. Instead, they praised and cursed only by Ida, who is the elder of those who plough and plant and tend the beasts. So Ida blessed her weaklings with the increase of their plants and beasts. This did not please El, but he ignored them, for he still had the hardy folk of the ships and the waves. They blessed by him, and they cursed by him, and to encourage their strength, he sent them storms and cold winters. But as time went on, those loyal to El dwindled. The soft folk of the soil seduced the sailors and bore them children, fit only for tending to the dirt. And the folk left the winter shores and ice-strewn pastures, and moved south to the soft lands of grapes and grains. Fewer and fewer folk came each year to plough the waves and reap the fish that El had decreed to them. Less and less often did El hear his name in a blessing or a curse, until at last there was a day when there was only one left who only blessed or cursed in El's name. And he was a skinny old man, too old for the sea, swollen and aching in his joints, with few teeth left in his head. His blessings and curses were weak things, and insulted more than pleased El, who had little use for rickety old men. At last, there came a storm that should have ended the old man and his small boat, but when the cold waves closed over him, he clung to the wreckage of his craft and dared to cry El for mercy, though all know mercy is not in him. So enraged was El by this blasphemy that he would not receive the old man into his sea, but instead cast him up upon the shores and cursed him that he could never more sail, but neither could he die. And when he crawled from the salt waves, his face and body were pocked as if barnacles had clung to him, and he staggered to his feet and went forth into the soft lands. And everywhere he went, he saw only soft soil grubbers, and he warned them of their folly, and that El would raise up a new and hardier folk and give their heritage to them. But the folk would not listen, so soft and set they'd become. Yet everywhere the old man went, disease followed in his wake. And it was all the pox disease he spread, the ones that care not if a man is strong or weak, hard or soft, but take any and all that they touch. And this was fitting, for all know that the poxes come up from bad dust and are spread by the turning of the soil. Thus is the tale told, and so the pocked man has become the harbinger of death and disease, and a rebuke for those who live soft and easily, because their lands bear well. Verity's return to Buck Keep was gravely marred by the events at Forge. Verity, pragmatic to a fault, had himself left Bay Guard as soon as Dukes Kelvar and Shemshai had shown themselves in accord regarding Watch Island. Verity and his picked troops had actually left Bay Guard before Chade and I returned to the inn, so the trek back had a hollow feel to it. During the days, and around the fires at night, folk spoke of Forge, and even within our caravan, the stories multiplied and embroidered themselves. My journey was spoiled by Chade's resumption of his noisome charade as the vile old lady. I had to fetch and wait upon her, right up to the time that her Buckkeep servants appeared to escort her back up to her chambers. She lived in the women's wing, and though I devoted myself in the days to come to hear any and all gossip about her, I heard nothing except that she was reclusive and difficult. How Chade had created her and maintained her fictitious existence, I never completely discovered. Buckkeep, in our absence, seemed to have undergone a tempest of new events, so that I felt as if we had been gone 10 years rather than a matter of weeks. Not even Forge could completely eclipse Lady Grace's performance. The story was told and retold, with minstrels vying to see whose recounting would become the standard. I heard that Duke Kelvar actually went down on one knee and kissed the tips of her fingers after she had spoken, very eloquently, about making the towers the grand jewels of their land. One source even told me that Lord Shemshai had personally thanked the lady and sought to dance often with her that evening, and thus nearly precipitated an entirely different disagreement between the neighboring dukedoms. I was glad of her success. I even heard it whispered more than once that Prince Verity should find himself a lady of like sentiments. As often as he was away, settling internal matters and chasing raiders, the people were beginning to feel the need of a strong ruler at home. The old king, Shrewd, was still nominally our sovereign, but, as Burridge observed, the people tended to look ahead. And, he added, folk like to know the king-in-waiting has a warm bed to come home to. It gives them something to make their fancies about. Few enough of them can afford any romance in their lives, so they imagine all they can for their king. Or prince. But Verity himself, I knew, had no time to think about well-warmed beds, or any sort of bed at all. Forge had been both an example and a threat. Word of others followed, three in swift succession. Croft, up in the near islands, had apparently been raider-forged, as it came to be known some weeks earlier. Word was slow to come from icy shores, but when it came, it was grim. Croft folk, too, had been taken hostage. The council of the town had, like Shrewd, been mystified by the Red Ship's ultimatum that they pay tribute, or their hostages would be returned. They had not paid. And like Forge, their hostages had been returned, mostly sound of body, but bereft of any of the kinder emotions of humanity. The whispered word was that Croft had been more direct in their solution. The harsh climates of the near islands bred a harsh people. Yet even they had deemed it kindness when they took the sword to their now heartless kin. Two other villages were raided after Forge. At Rock Gate, the folk had paid the ransom. Parts of bodies had washed up the next day, and the village had gathered to bury them. The news came to Buck Keep with no apologies, only with the unvoiced assumption that had the king been more vigilant, they would have had warning of the raid at least. Sheepmire met the challenge squarely. They refused to pay the tribute, but with the rumors of Forge running hot through the land, they prepared themselves. They had met their returned hostages with halters and shackles. They took their own folk back, clubbing them senseless in some cases, before tying them and taking them back into their rightful homes. The village was united in attempting to bring them back to their former selves. The tales from Sheepmire were the most told ones. Of a mother who snapped at a child brought to her for nursing, declaring as she cursed at it that she had no use for the whimpering, wet creature. Of the little child who cried and screamed at his bonds, only to fly at his own father with a toasting fork as soon as the heartbroken sire released him. Some cursed and fought and spat at their kin. Others settled into a life of bondage and idleness, eating the food and drinking the ale set before them, but offering no words of thanks or affection. Freed of restraints, those ones did not attack their own families, but neither did they work, nor even join with them in their evening pastimes. They stole without remorse, even from their own children, and squandered coin, and gobbled food like gluttons. No joy they gave to anyone, not even a kind word. But the word from Sheepmire was that the folk there intended to persevere until the Red Ship Sickness passed. That gave the nobles of Buckkeep a bit of hope to cling to. They spoke of the courage of the villagers with admiration, and vowed that they too would do the same if kin of theirs were raider-forged. Sheepmire and its brave inhabitants became a rallying point for the six duchies. King Shrewd levied more taxes in their name. Some went to provide grain for those so occupied with caring for bound kin that they had no time to rebuild their ravaged flocks or replant their burned fields. And some went to build more ships and hire more men to patrol the coastlines. At first, folk took pride in what they would do. Those who lived on the sea cliffs began to keep volunteer watch. Runners and messenger birds and signal fires were kept in place. Some villages sent sheep and supplies to Sheepmire to be given to those who needed help most. But as the long weeks passed and there was no sign that any of the returned hostages had recovered their sensibilities, those hopes and devotions began to seem pathetic rather than noble. Those who had most supported these efforts now declared that, were they taken hostage, they would choose to be hacked to pieces and thrown into the sea rather than returned to cause their families such hardship and heartbreak. Worst, I think, was that in such a time the throne itself had no firm idea of what to do. Had a royal edict been issued to say either that folk must or must not pay the demanded tribute for hostages, it would have gone better. No matter which, some folk would have disagreed, but at least the king would have taken a stand, and people would have had some sense that this threat was being faced. Instead, the increased patrols and watches only made it seem that Buckkeep itself was in terror of this new threat, but had no strategy for facing it. In the absence of royal edict, the coastal villages took things into their own hands. The councils met to decide what they would do if forged, and some decided one way, and some the other.
"But in every case," Chade told me wearily, "it matters not what they decide. It weakens their loyalty to the kingdom. Whether they pay the tribute or not, the raiders may laugh over their blood ale at us. For in declaring our villagers are saying in their minds not if we are forged, but when we are forged. And thus they have already been raped in spirit, if not in flesh. They look at their kin, mother at child, men at parents, and already they have given them up to death or forging. And the kingdom fails, for as each town must decide alone, so it is separated from the whole. We will shatter into a thousand little townships, each worrying only about what it will do for itself if it is raided. If Shrewd and Verity do not act quickly, the kingdom will become a thing that exists only in name and in the minds of its former rulers."
"But what can they do?" I demanded. "No matter what edict is passed, it will be wrong." I picked up the tongs and pushed the crucible I was tending a bit deeper into the flames.
"Sometimes," grumbled Chade, "it is better to be defiantly wrong than silent. Look, boy, if you, a mere lad, can realize that either decision is wrong, so can all folk. But at least such an edict would give us a common response. It would not be as if each village were left to lick its own wounds. And in addition to such an edict, Shrewd and Verity should take other actions.
He leaned closer to peer at the bubbling liquid.
More heat,
he suggested. I picked up a small bellows, plied it carefully.
Such as? Organize raids on the out-islanders in return. Provide vessels and supplies to any willing to undertake such a raid. Forbid that herds and flocks be grazed so temptingly on the coast pastures. Supply more arms to the villages if we cannot give each one men to protect it. By Eda's plow! Give them pellets of carrot seed and nightshade to carry in pouches about their wrists, so that if they are captured in a raid, they can take their own lives instead of being hostages. Anything, boy, anything the king did at this point would be better than this damn indecisiveness.
I sat, staring at Chade. I had never heard him speak so forcefully, nor had I ever known him to criticize Shrewd so openly. It shocked me. I held my breath, hoping he'd say more, but almost fearful of what I might hear. He seemed unaware of my stare.
Poke that a bit deeper. Be careful. If it explodes, King Shrewd may have himself two pocked men instead of one.
He glanced at me.
Yes. That's how I was marked. But it might have well and truly been a pox, for how Shrewd hears me lately.
Ill omens and warnings and cautions fill you, he said to me. But I think you want the boy trained in the skill simply because you are not.
It's a bad ambition, Chade. Put it from you.
There speaks the queen's ghost with the king's tongue.
Chade's bitterness filled me with stillness.
Chivalry. That's who we need now.
He went on after a moment.
Shrewd holds back. And Verity is a good soldier, but he listens to his father too much. Verity was raised to be second, not first. He does not take the initiative. We need chivalry. He'd go into those towns, talk to the folk who have lost loved ones to forging. Damn! He'd even talk to the forged ones themselves.
Do you think it would do any good? I asked softly. I scarcely dared to move. I sensed that Chade was thinking more to himself than to me.
It wouldn't solve it, no. But our folk would have a sense of their ruler's involvement. Sometimes that's all it takes, boy. But all Verity does is march his toy soldiers about and waste strategies, and Shrewd watches it happen, and thinks not of his people, but only of how to assure that Regal can be kept safe and yet readied in power should Verity manage to get himself killed.
Regal? I blurted in amazement. Regal, with his pretty clothes and cockerel posturings? Always he was at Shrewd's heels, but never had I thought of him as a real prince. To hear his name come up in such a discussion jolted me.
He has become his father's favorite, Chade growled. Shrewd has done nothing but spoil him since the queen died. He tries to buy the boy's heart with gifts, now that his mother is no longer around to claim his allegiance, and Regal takes full advantage. He speaks only what the old man loves to hear, and Shrewd gives him too much rein. He lets him wander about, squandering coin on useless visits to Pharaoh and Tilth, where his mother's people fill Regal full of ideas of his self-importance. The boy should be kept at home and made to give some account for how he spends his time, and the king's money. What he spends gallivanting about would have outfitted a warship.
And then, suddenly,
"That's too hot! You'll lose it! Fish it out, quickly!"
But his words came too late, for the crucible cracked with a noise like breaking ice, and its contents filled Chade's tower room with an acrid smoke that brought all lessons and talk to an end for that night. I was not summoned again. My other lessons went on, but I missed Chade as the weeks passed, and he did not call for me. I knew he was not displeased with me, but only preoccupied. When, idle one day, I pushed my awareness toward him, I felt only secrecy and discordance, and a wallop to the back of my head when Burridge caught me at it.
"Stop it," he hissed.
and ignored my studied look of shocked innocence. He glanced about the stall I was mucking out, as if he expected to find a dog or cat lurking.
"There's nothing here," he exclaimed.
"Just manure and straw," I agreed, rubbing the back of my head.
"Then what were you doing?"
"Daydreaming," I muttered. "That was all."
"You can't fool me, Fitz," he growled. "And I won't have it, not in my stables. You won't pervert my beasts that way, or degrade chivalry's blood. Mind what I've told you."
I clenched my jaws and lowered my eyes and kept on working. After a time I heard him sigh and move away. I went on raking, inwardly seething and resolving never to let Burrich come up on me unawares again. The rest of that summer was such a whirlpool of events that I find it hard to recall their progression. Overnight, the very feeling of the air seemed to change. When I went into town, all of the talk was of fortifications and readiness. Only two more towns were forged that summer, but it seemed 100, for the stories of it were repeated and enlarged from lip to lip.
"Until it seems as if that is all folk talk about any more,"
Molly complained to me. We were walking on Long Beach, in the light of the summer evening sun. The wind off the water was a welcome bit of cool after a muggy day. Burrich had been called away to Spring Mouth to see if he could figure out why all the cattle there were developing huge hide sores. It meant no morning lessons for me, but many, many more chores with the horses and hounds in his absence, especially as Cobb had gone to Turlake with Regal to manage his horses and hounds for a summer hunt. But the opposite weight of the balance was that my evenings were less supervised, and I had more time to visit town. My evening walks with Molly were almost routine now. Her father's health was failing, and he scarcely needed a drink to fall into an early and deep sleep each night. Molly would pack a bit of cheese and sausage for us, or a small loaf and some smoked fish, and we would take a basket and a bottle of cheap wine and walk out down the beach to the breakwater rocks. There we would sit on the rocks, as they gave up the last heat of the day, and Molly would tell me about her day's work and the day's gossip, and I would listen. Sometimes our elbows bumped as we walked.
"Sarah, the butcher's daughter, told me that she positively yearns for winter to come. The winds and ice will beat the red ships back to their own shores for a bit, and give us a rest from fear," she says. "But then Kelty up and says that maybe we'll be able to stop fearing more forging, but that we'll still have to fear the forged folk that are loose in our land. Rumor says that some from Forge have left there, now that there's nothing left for them to steal, and that they travel about as bandits, robbing travelers."
"I doubt it. More than likely it's other folk doing the robbing, but trying to pass themselves off as forged folk to send revenge looking elsewhere. Forged folk don't have enough kinship left in them to be a band of anything." I contradicted her lazily. I was looking out across the bay, my eyes almost closed against the glare of the sun on the water. I didn't have to look at Molly to feel her there beside me. It was an interesting tension, one I didn't fully understand. She was 16, and I about 14, and those 2 years loomed between us like an insurmountable wall. Yet she always made time for me, and seemed to enjoy my company. She seemed as aware of me as I was of her, but if I quested toward her at all, she would draw back, halting to shake a pebble from her shoe, or suddenly speaking of her father's illness and how much he needed her. Yet, if I drew my sensings back from that tension, she became uncertain and shyer of speech, and would try to look at my face and the set of my mouth and eyes. I didn't understand it, but it was as if we held a string taut between us. But now I heard an edge of annoyance in her speech.
"Oh, I see. And you know so much of forged folk, do you, more than those who have been robbed by them?"
Her tart words caught me off balance, and it was a moment or two before I could speak. Molly knew nothing of Chade and me, let alone of my side trip with him to Forge. To her, I was an errand boy for the keep, working for the stable master when I wasn't fetching for the scribe. I couldn't betray my first-hand knowledge, let alone how I had sensed what forging was. I've heard the talk of the guards, when they're around the stables and kitchens at night. Soldiers like them have seen much of all kinds of folk, and they're the ones who say that the forged ones have no friendships, no family, no kinship ties at all left. Still, I suppose if one of them took to robbing travellers, others would copy him, and it would be almost the same as a band of robbers. Perhaps. She seemed mollified by my comments.
Look, let's climb up there to eat.
Up there was a shelf on the cliff's edge, rather than the breakwater. But I assented with a nod, and the next handful of minutes was spent in getting ourselves and our basket up there. It required more arduous climbing than our earlier expeditions had. I caught myself watching to see how Molly would manage her skirts, and taking opportunities to catch at her arm to balance her, or take her hand to help her up a steep bit while she kept hold of the basket. In a flash of insight, I knew that Molly's suggestion that we climb had been her way of manipulating the situation to cause this. We finally gained the ledge and sat, looking out over the water with her basket between us, and I was savoring my awareness of her awareness of me. It reminded me of the clubs of the Springfest jugglers as they handed them back and forth, back and forth, more and more, and faster and faster. The silence lasted, until a time when one of us had to speak. I looked at her, but she looked aside. She looked into the basket and said, "Oh, dandelion wine! I thought that wasn't any good until after midwinter." "It's last year's. It's had a winter to age," I told her, and took it from her to work the cork loose with my knife. She watched me worry at it for a while, and then took it from me, and drawing her own slender sheath knife, she speared and twisted it out with a practiced knack that I envied. She caught my look and shrugged. "I've been pulling corks for my father for as long as I can remember. It used to be because he was too drunk. Now he doesn't have the strength in his hands any more, even when he's sober." Pain and bitterness mingled in her words. I floundered for a more pleasant topic.
"Look, the Rain Maiden!"
I pointed out over the water to a sleek-hulled ship coming into the harbour under oars. I've always thought her the most beautiful ship in the harbour. "She's been on patrol. The cloth merchants took up a collection. Almost every merchant in town contributed. Even I. Although all I could spare was candles for her lanterns. She's manned with fighters now, and escorts the ships between here and High Downs. The Green Spey meets them there, and takes them farther up the coast." "I hadn't heard that." And it surprised me that I had not heard such a thing in the keep itself. My heart sank in me, that even Buckkeep Town was taking measures independent of the king's advice or counsel. I said as much.
"Well, folk have to do whatever they can if all King Shrewd is going to do is click his tongue and frown about it. It's well enough for him to bid us to be strong when he sits secure up in his castle. It isn't as if his son or brother or little girl would be forged."
It shamed me that I could think of nothing to say in my king's defense, and shame stung me to say, "Well, you're almost as safe as the king himself, living here below in Buckkeep Town." Molly looked at me, levelly. "I had a cousin, apprenticed out in Forge Town." She paused, then said carefully, "Will you think me cold when I say that we were relieved to hear he had only been killed? It was uncertain for a week or so, but finally we had word from one who had seen him die, and my father and I were both relieved. We could grieve, knowing that his life was simply over, and we would miss him. We no longer had to wonder if he was still alive and behaving like a beast, causing misery to others and shame to himself.
I was silent for a bit. Then, I'm sorry. It seemed inadequate, and I reached out to pat her motionless hand. For a second, it was almost as if I couldn't feel her there, as if her pain had shocked her into an emotional numbness, the equal of a forged one. But then she sighed, and I felt her presence again beside me. "You know," I ventured, "perhaps the king himself does not know what to do either. Perhaps he is at as great a loss for a solution as we are."
"He is the king," Molly protested, "and named Shrewd to be shrewd. Folks are saying now he but holds back to keep the strings of his purse tight. Why should he pay out of his hoard when desperate merchants will hire mercenaries of their own? But enough of this."
And she held up a hand to stop my words. "This is not why we came out here into the peace and coolness, to talk of politics and fears. Tell me instead of what you've been doing. Has the speckled bitch had her pups yet?"
And so we spoke of other things, of Motley's puppies, and of the wrong stallion getting at a mare in season. And then she told me of gathering green cones to scent her candles and picking blackberries, and how busy she would be for the next week trying to make blackberry preserves for the winter while still tending the shop and making candles. We talked and ate and drank, and watched the late sun of summer as it lingered low on the horizon, almost, but not quite, setting. I felt the tension as a pleasant thing between us, as a suspension and a wonder both. I viewed it as an extension of my strange new sense, and so I marveled that Molly seemed to feel and react to it as well. I wanted to speak to her about it, to ask her if she was aware of other folk in a similar way. But I feared that if I asked her, I might reveal myself as I had to Chade, or that she might be disgusted by it, as I knew Burridge would be. So I smiled, and we talked, and I kept my thoughts to myself. I walked her home through the quiet streets, and bid her good night at the door of the chandlery. She paused a moment, as if thinking of something else she wanted to say, but then gave me only a quizzical look, and softly muttered, "Good night, new boy." I took myself home under a deeply blue sky pierced by bright stars, past the sentries at their eternal dice game, and up to the stables. I made a quick round of the stalls, but all was calm and well there, even with the new puppies. I noticed two strange horses in one of the paddocks, and one lady's palfrey had been stabled. Some visiting noblewoman come to court, I decided. I wondered what had brought her here at the end of the summer, and admired the quality of her horses. Then I left the stables and headed up to the keep. By habit, my path took me through the kitchens. Cook was familiar with the appetites of stable-boys and men-at-arms, and knew that regular meals did not always suffice to keep one full. Especially lately I had found myself getting hungry at all hours, while Mistress Hasty had recently declared that if I didn't stop growing so rapidly, I should have to wrap myself in bark cloth like a wild man, for she had no idea how to keep me looking as if my clothes fit. I was already thinking of a big earthenware bowl that cook kept full of soft biscuits and covered with a cloth, and of a certain wheel of especially sharp cheese, and how well both would go with some ale when I entered the kitchen door. There was a woman at the table. She had been eating an apple and cheese, but at the sight of me coming in the door she sprang up and put her hand over her heart, as if she thought I were the pot man himself. I paused. "I did not mean to startle you, lady. I was merely hungry, and thought to get myself some food. Will it bother you if I stay?" The lady slowly sank back into her seat. I wondered privately what someone of her rank was doing alone in the kitchen at night, for her high birth was something that could not be disguised by the simple cream robe she wore, or the weariness in her face. This, undoubtedly, was the rider of the palfrey in the stable, and not some lady's maid. If she had awakened hungry at night, why hadn't she simply bestirred a servant to fetch something for her?
Her hand rose from clutching at her breast to pat at her lips, as if to steady her uneven breath. When she spoke, her voice was well modulated, almost musical. "I would not keep you from your food. I was simply a bit startled. You came in so suddenly." "My thanks, lady." I moved around the big kitchen, from ale cask to cheese to bread, but everywhere I went, her eyes followed me. Her food lay ignored on the table where she had dropped it when I came in. I turned from pouring myself a mug of ale to find her eyes wide upon me. Instantly she dropped them away. Her mouth worked, but she said nothing. "May I do something for you?" I asked politely. "Help you find something? Would you care for some ale?"
"If you would be so kind."
She said the words softly. I brought her the mug I had just filled and set it on the table before her. She drew back when I came near her, as if I carried some contagion. I wondered if I smelled bad from my stable work earlier. I decided not, for Molly would have surely mentioned it. Molly was ever frank with me about such things. I drew another mug for myself, and then, looking about, decided it would be better to carry my food off up to my room. The lady's whole attitude bespoke her uneasiness at my presence. But as I was struggling to balance biscuits and cheese and mug, she gestured at the bench opposite her.
"Sit down,"
she told me, as if she had read my thoughts.
"It is not right I should scare you away from your meal."
Her tone was neither command nor invitation, but something in between. I took the seat she indicated, my ale slopping over a bit as I juggled food and mug into place. I felt her eyes on me as I sat. Her own food remained ignored before her. I ducked my head to avoid that gaze and ate quickly, as furtively as a rat in a corner who suspects a cat is behind the door, waiting. She did not stare rudely, but openly watched me, with the sort of observation that made my hands clumsy and led to my acute awareness that I had just, unthinkingly, wiped my mouth on the back of my sleeve. I could think of nothing to say, and yet the silence jabbed at me. The biscuit seemed dry in my mouth, making me cough, and when I tried to wash it down with ale, I choked. Her eyebrows twitched, her mouth set more firmly. Even with my eyes lowered to my plate, I felt her gaze. I rushed through my food, wanting only to escape her hazel eyes and straight, silent mouth. I pushed the last hunks of bread and cheese into my mouth and stood up quickly, bumping against the table and almost knocking the bench over in my haste. I headed toward the door, then remembered Burridge's instructions about excusing oneself from a lady's presence. I swallowed my half-chewed mouthful.
"Good night to you, lady,"
I muttered, thinking the words not quite right, but unable to summon better. I crabbed toward the door.
"Wait,"
she said. And when I paused, she asked,
"Do you sleep upstairs, or out in the stables?"
"Both. Sometimes, I mean either.
Good night then, lady."
I turned and all but fled. I was halfway up the stairs before I wondered at the strangeness of her question. It was only when I went to undress for bed that I realized I still gripped my empty ale mug. I went to sleep, feeling a fool, and wondering why.
12. Patience. The Red Ship Raiders were a misery and an affliction to their own folk long before they troubled the shores of the Six Duchies. From obscure cult beginnings they rose to both religious and political power by means of ruthless tactics. Chiefs and headmen who refused to align with their beliefs often found that their wives and children had become the victims of what we have come to call forging, in memory of the ill-fated town of Forge. Hard-hearted and cruel as we consider the Out-Islanders to be, They have in their tradition a strong vein of honor and heinous penalties for those who break the kin rules. Imagine the anguish of the out-islander father whose son has been forged. He must either conceal his son's crimes when the boy lies to him, steals from him, and forces himself upon the household women, or see the boy flayed alive for his crimes and suffer the losses of both heir and the respect of the other houses. The threat of forging was a powerful deterrent to opposing the political power of the Red Ship Raiders. By the time the Red Ship Raiders began to seriously harry our shores, they had subdued most opposition in the Out Islands. Those who openly opposed them died or fled. Others grudgingly paid tribute and clenched their teeth against the outrages of those who controlled the cult. But many gladly joined the ranks and painted the hulls of their raiding vessels red and never questioned the rightness of what they did. It seems likely that these converts were formed mostly from the lesser houses who had never before been offered the opportunity to rise in influence. But he who controlled the Red Ship Raiders cared nothing for who a man's forebears had been, so long as he had the man's unswerving loyalty. I saw the lady twice more before I discovered who she was. The second time I saw her was the next night, at about the same hour. Molly had been busy with her berries, so I had gone out for an evening of tavern music with Carrie and Dirk. I had had perhaps one, or at most two mugs more of ale than I should have. I was neither dizzy nor sick, but I was placing my feet carefully, for I had already taken one tumble in a pothole on the dusky road. Separate, but adjacent to the dusty kitchen courtyard, with its cobbles and wagon docks, is a hedged area. It is commonly referred to as the women's garden, not because it is exclusively their province, but simply because they have the tending and the knowing of it. It is a pleasant place, with a pond in the middle, and many low beds of herbs set among flowering plantings, fruit vines, and green-stoned pathways. I knew better than to go straight to bed when I was in this condition. If I attempted to sleep now, the bed would begin to spin and sway, and within an hour I would be puking sick. It had been a pleasant evening, and that seemed a wretched way to end it. So I took myself to the women's garden instead of my room. In one angle of the garden, between a sun-warmed wall and a smaller pond, there grow seven varieties of thyme. Their fragrances on a hot day can be giddying, but now, with evening verging on night, the mingling scents seemed to smooth my head. I splashed my face in the little pond, and then put my back to the rock wall that was still releasing the sun's heat back to the night. Frogs were chirruping to one another. I lowered my eyes and watched the pond's calm surface to keep myself from spinning. Footsteps. Then a woman's voice asked tartly, "Are you drunk?" "Not quite," I replied affably, thinking it was Tilly, the orchard girl. "Not quite enough time or coin," I added jokingly. "I suppose you learned it from Burridge. The man is a sot and a lecher, and he has cultivated like traits in you. Ever he brings those around him down to his level." The bitterness in the woman's voice made me look up. I squinted through the dimming light to make out her features. It was the lady of the previous evening. Standing on the garden path in a simple shift, she looked at first glance to be little more than a girl. She was slender and less tall than I, though I was not overly tall for my 14 years. But her face was a woman's, and right now her mouth was set in a condemning line, echoed by the brows knit over her hazel eyes. Her hair was dark and curling, and though she had tried to restrain it, ringlets of it had escaped at her forehead and neck. It was not that I felt compelled to defend Burridge. It was simply that my condition was no doing of his. So I made answer, something to the effect that he was some miles distant in a different town. He could scarcely be responsible for what I put in my mouth and swallowed. The lady came 2 steps closer. "But he has never taught you better, has he? He has never counseled you against drunkenness, has he? There is a saying from the Southlands that there is truth in wine. There must be a bit of it in ale also. I spoke it that night.
Actually, my lady, he would be greatly displeased with me right now. First, he would berate me for not arising when a lady spoke to me. And here I lurched to my feet. And then he would lecture me long and severely about the behavior expected from one who carries a prince's blood, if not his titles. I managed a bow, and when I succeeded, I distinguished myself by straightening up with a flourish. So good evening to you, fair lady of the garden. I bid you good night, and I shall remove my oafish self from your presence. I was all the way to the arched entryway in the wall, when she called out, "Wait!" But my stomach gave a quietly protesting grumble, and I pretended not to hear. She did not come after me, but I felt sure she watched me, and so I kept my head up and my stride even, until I was out of the kitchen courtyard. I took myself down to the stables, where I vomited into the manure pile, and ended up sleeping in a clean, empty stall, because the steps up to Burridge's loft looked entirely too steep. But youth is amazingly resilient, especially when feeling threatened. I was up at dawn the next day, for I knew Burridge was expected home by afternoon. I washed myself at the stables and decided the tunic I had worn for the last 3 days needed to be replaced. I was doubly conscious of its condition when in the corridor outside my room the lady accosted me. She looked me up and down, and before I could speak, she addressed me. "Change your shirt," she told me, and then added, "Those leggings make you look like a stork. Tell Mistress Hasty they need replacing." "Good morning, lady," I said. It was not a reply, but those were the only words that came to me in my astonishment. I decided she was very eccentric, even more so than Lady Time. My best course was to humour her. I expected her to turn aside and go on her way. Instead, she continued to hold me with her eyes. "Do you play a musical instrument?" she demanded. I shook my head mutely. "You sing, then?"
"No, my lady."
She looked troubled as she asked,
"Then perhaps you have been taught to recite the epics and the knowledge verses of herbs and healings and navigation, that sort of thing?"
"Only the ones that pertain to the care of horses, hawks, and dogs,"
I told her, almost honestly. Burridge had demanded I learn those. Chade had taught me a set about poisons and antidotes, but he had warned me they were not commonly known and were not to be casually recited.
"But you dance, of course. And have you been instructed in the making of verse?"
I was totally confused.
"Lady, I think you have confused me with someone else. Perhaps you are thinking of August, the king's nephew. He is but a year or two younger than I, and..."
"I am not mistaken. Answer my question," she demanded, almost shrilly.
"No, my lady. The teachings you speak of are for those who are well-born. I have not been taught them."
At each of my denials she had appeared more troubled. Her mouth grew straighter, and her hazel eyes clouded.
"This is not to be tolerated," she declared, and turned in a flurry of skirts.
She hastened off down the hallway. After a moment I went into my room, changed my shirt, and put on the longest pair of leggings I owned. I dismissed the lady from my thoughts, and threw myself into my chores and lessons for the day. It was raining that afternoon when Burridge returned. I met him outside the stables, taking his horse's head as he swung stiffly down from the saddle.
"You've grown, Fitz,"
he observed, and looked me over with a critical eye, as if I were a horse or hound that was showing unexpected potential. He opened his mouth as if to say something more, then shook his head and gave a half-snort.
"Well?"
he asked, and I began my report. He had been gone scarcely more than a month, but Burridge liked to know things down to the smallest detail. He walked beside me, listening, as I led his horse to stall and proceeded to care for her. Sometimes it surprised me how much like Chade he could be. They were very alike in the way they expected me to recall exact details, and to be able to relate the doings of last week or last month in correct order. Learning to report for Chade had not been that difficult. He had merely formalized the requirements that Burridge had long expected of me. Years later, I was to realize how similar it was to the reporting of a man-at-arms to his superior. Another man would have gone off to the kitchens or the baths after hearing my summarized version of everything that had gone on in his absence, but Burridge insisted on walking through his stables, stopping here to chat with a groom, and there to speak softly to a horse. When he came to the lady's old palfrey, he stopped. He looked at the horse for a few minutes in silence. "I trained this beast," he said abruptly. And at his voice, the horse turned in the stall to face him and whickered softly. "Silk," he said softly, and stroked the soft nose. He sighed suddenly. "So the Lady Patience is here. Has she seen you yet?" Now there was a question difficult to answer. A thousand thoughts collided in my head at once. The Lady Patience. My father's wife, and by many accounts, the one most responsible for my father's withdrawal from the court and from me. That was who I had been chatting with in the kitchen, and drunkenly saluting. That was who quizzed me this morning on my education. "To Burridge," I muttered. "Not formally, but we've met." He surprised me by laughing.
"Your face is a picture, Fitz. I can see she hasn't changed much just by your reaction. The first time I met her was in your father's orchard. She was sitting up in a tree. She demanded that I remove a splinter from her foot, and took her shoe and stocking off right there so I could do it, right there in front of me. And she had no idea at all who I was, nor I her. I thought she was a lady's maid. That was years ago, of course, and even a few years before my prince met her. I suppose I wasn't much older than you are now."
He paused, and his face softened.
"And she had a wretched little dog she always carried about with her in a basket. It was always wheezing and retching up wads of its own fur. Its name was Feather Duster."
He paused a moment, and smiled almost fondly.
"What a thing to remember. After all these years."
"Did she like you when she first met you?"
I asked tactlessly. Burridge looked at me, and his eyes became opaque, the man disappearing behind the gaze.
"Better than she does now," he said abruptly. "But that's of small import. Let's hear it, Fitz. What does she think of you?"
Now there was another question. I plunged into an accounting of our meetings, glossing over details as much as I dared. I was halfway through my garden encounter when Burridge held up a hand.
"Stop," he said quietly.
I fell silent.
"When you cut pieces out of the truth to avoid looking like a fool, you end up sounding like a moron instead. Let's start again."
So I did, and spared him nothing of either my behavior or the lady's comments. When I was finished, I waited for his judgment. Instead, he reached out and stroked the palfrey's nose.
"Some things are changed by time," he said at last,
"and others are not." He sighed.
"Well, Fitz, you have a way of presenting yourself to the very people you should most ardently avoid. I am sure there will be consequences from this, but I have not yet the slightest idea of what they will be. That being so, there's no point to worrying. Let's see the rat dog's pups. You say she had 6?
"And all survived," I said proudly, for the bitch had a history of difficult whelping.
"Let's just hope we do as well for ourselves,"
Burridge muttered as we walked through the stables. But when I glanced up at him, surprised, he seemed not to have been talking to me at all.
"I'd have thought you'd have the good sense to avoid her,"
Chade grumbled at me. It was not the greeting I had looked for after more than 2 months' absence from his chambers. "I didn't know it was the Lady Patience. I'm surprised there was not gossip about her arrival."
"She strongly objects to gossip,"
Chade informed me.
He sat in his chair before the small fire in the fireplace. Chade's chambers were chilly, and he was ever vulnerable to cold. He looked weary as well tonight, worn by whatever he had been doing in the week since I'd last seen him. His hands especially looked old, bony and lumpy about the knuckles. He took a sip of his wine and continued,
"And she has her eccentric little ways of dealing with those who talk about her behind her back. She has always insisted on privacy for herself. It is one reason she would have made a very poor queen. Not that chivalry cared. That was a marriage he made for himself, rather than for politics. I think it was the first major disappointment he dealt his father. After that, nothing he did ever completely pleased Shrewd."
I sat still as a mouse. Slink came and perched on my knee. It was rare to hear Chade so talkative, especially about matters relating to the royal family. I scarcely breathed for fear of interrupting him.
"Sometimes I think there was something in Patience that chivalry instinctively knew he needed. He was a thoughtful, orderly man, always correct in his manners, always aware of precisely what was going on around him. He was chivalrous boy, in the best sense of that word. He did not give in to ugly or petty impulses. That meant he exuded a certain air of restraint at all times, so those who did not know him well thought him cold or cavalier. And then he met this girl, and she was scarcely more than a girl, and there was no more substance to her than to cobwebs and seafoam. Thoughts and tongue always flying from this to that, knittedly, natteredly, with never a pause or connection I could see. It used to exhaust me just to listen to her. But chivalry would smile and marvel. Perhaps it was that she had absolutely no awe of him. Perhaps it was that she didn't seem particularly eager to win him. But with a score of more eligible ladies of better birth and brighter brains pursuing him, he chose Patience. And it wasn't even timely for him to wed. When he took her to wife, he shut the gate on a dozen possible alliances that a wife could have brought him. There was no good reason for him to get married at that time. Not one.
Except that he wanted to, I said. And then I could have bitten my tongue, for Chade nodded, and then gave himself a bit of a shake. He took his gaze off the fire and looked at me.
"Well, enough of that. I won't ask you how you made such an impression on her or what changed her heart toward you, but last week she came to Shrewd and demanded that you be recognized as chivalry's son and heir and given an education appropriate to a prince."
I was dizzied. Did the wall tapestries move before me, or was it a trick of my eyes?
"Of course he refused,"
Chade continued mercilessly.
"He tried to explain to her why such a thing is totally impossible. All she kept saying was, 'But you are the king. How can it be impossible for you? The nobles would never accept him. It would mean civil war, and think what it would do to an unprepared boy to plunge him suddenly into this,' he told her."
"Oh," I said quietly. I couldn't remember what I had felt for the one instant. Elation? Anger? Fear? I only knew that the feeling was gone now, and I felt oddly stripped and humiliated that I had felt anything at all.
"Patience, of course, was not convinced at all. 'Prepare the boy,' she told the king, 'and when he is ready, judge for yourself.' Only Patience would ask such a thing, and in front of both Verity and Regal. Verity listened quietly, knowing how it must end, but Regal was livid. He becomes overwrought far too easily. Even an idiot should know Shrewd could not accede to Patience's demand. But he knows when to compromise. In all else, he gave way to her, mostly, I think, to stop her tongue."
"In all else?" I repeated stupidly.
"Some for our good, some for our detriment, or at least for our damned inconvenience."
Chade sounded both annoyed and elated.
"I hope you can find more hours in the day, boy, for I'm not willing to sacrifice any of my plans for hers. Patience has demanded that you be educated as befits your bloodlines. and she has vowed to undertake such educating herself. Music, poetry, dance, song, manners. I hope you've a better tolerance for it than I did, though it never seemed to hurt chivalry. Sometimes he even put such knowledge to good use, but it will take up a good part of your day. You'll be acting as a page for Patience as well. You're old for it, but she insisted. Personally, I think she regrets much and is trying to make up for lost time, something that never works. You'll have to cut back your weapons training. And Burridge will have to find himself another stable boy. I didn't give a peg about the weapons training. As Chade had often pointed out to me, a really good assassin worked close and quietly. If I learned my trade well, I wouldn't be swinging a long blade at anyone. But my time with Burridge, again I had the odd sensation of not knowing how I felt. I hated Burridge. Sometimes. He was overbearing, dictatorial, and insensitive. He expected me to be perfect, yet bluntly told me that I would never be rewarded for it. But he was also open and blunt, and believed I could achieve what he demanded. You're probably wondering what advantage she won us. Chade went on obliviously. I heard suppressed excitement in his voice. It's something I've tried for twice for you, and been twice refused. But Patience nattered at Shrewd until he surrendered. It's the skill, boy. You're to be trained in the skill.
The skill, I repeated, without sense of what I was saying. It was all going too fast for me.
Yes.
I scrabbled to find thoughts. Burridge spoke of it to me once, a long time ago. Abruptly I remembered the context of that conversation, after Nosy accidentally betrayed us. He had spoken of it as the opposite of whatever was the sense I shared with animals. The same sense had revealed to me the change in the folk of Forge. Would training me in one free me of the other? Or would it be a deprivation? I thought of the kinship that I had shared with horses and dogs when I knew Burridge was not around. I remembered Nosy in a mingling of warmth and grief. I had never been so close before or since to another living creature. Would this new training in the skill take that away from me?
What's the matter, boy?
Chade's voice was kindly, but concerned.
I don't know.
I hesitated. But not even to Chade could I dare to reveal my fear or my taint.
Nothing, I guess.
You've been listening to old tales about the training,
he guessed, totally incorrectly.
Listen, boy. It can't be that bad. Chivalry went through it, so did Verity. And with the threat of the red ships, Shrewd has decided to go back to the old ways and extending the training to other likely candidates. He wants a coterie or even two to supplement what he and Verity can do with the skill. Galen is not enthused, but I suspect it's a very good idea. Though being a bastard myself, I was never allowed the training, so I have no real idea how the skill might be employed to defend the land.
You're a bastard?
The words burst out of me. All my tangled thoughts were suddenly sliced through by this revelation. Chade stared at me, as shocked at my words as I by his.
Of course. I thought you'd figured that out long ago. Boy, for someone as perceptive as you are, you've got some very odd blind spots.
I looked at Chade as if for the first time. His scars, perhaps, had hidden it from me. The resemblance was there, the brow, the way his ears were set, the line of his lower lip.
Your shrewd son,
I guessed wildly, going only by his appearance. Even before he spoke, I realized how foolish my words were.
Son?
Chade laughed grimly.
How he would scowl to hear you say that. But the truth makes him grimace even more. He is my younger half-brother, boy, though he was conceived in a wedded bed, and I on a military campaign near Sand's Edge.
Softly he added,
my mother was a soldier when I was conceived. but she returned home to bear me, and later wedded a potter. When my mother died, her husband put me on a donkey, gave me a necklace she had worn, and told me to take it to the king at Buckkeep. I was 10. It was a long, hard road from Woolcot to Buckkeep. In those days, I couldn't think of anything to say. Enough of this.
Chade straightened himself up sternly.
Galen will be instructing you in the skill. Shrewd browbeat him into it. He finally acceded, but with reservations. No one is to interfere with any of his students during the training. I wish it were otherwise, but there's nothing I can do about it. You'll just have to be careful. You know of Galen, don't you?
A little, I said. Only what other people say about him.
What do you know by yourself?
Chade quizzed me. I took a breath and considered. He eats alone. I've never seen him at table, either with the men-at-arms or in the dining hall. I've never seen him just standing about and talking, not in the exercise yard, or in the washing court, or in any of the gardens. He's always going somewhere when I see him, and he's always in a hurry. He's bad with animals. The dogs don't like him. And he over-controls the horses so much that he ruins their mouths and their temperaments. I guess he's about Burridge's age. He dresses well, almost as fancy as Regal. I've heard him called a Queen's man.
Why?
Chade asked quickly.
It was a long time ago. Gage, he's a man-at-arms. He came to Burridge one night, a bit drunk, a bit cut up. He'd had a fight with Galen, and Galen hit him in the face with a little whip or something. Gage asked Burridge to fix him up because it was late, and he wasn't supposed to have been drinking that night. His watch was coming up or something. Gage told Burridge that he'd overheard Galen say that Regal was twice as royal as chivalry or verity, and it was a stupid custom that kept him from the throne. Galen had said that Regal's mother was better born than Shrewd's first queen, which everyone knows is true. But what angered Gage enough to start the fight was that Galen said Queen Desire was more royal than Shrewd himself, for she'd far seer blood from both her parents, and Shrewd's was just from his father. So Gage swung at him, but Galen sidestepped and struck him in the face with something. I paused.
And?
Chade encouraged me.
And so he favours Regal, over Verity or even the king. And Regal, well, accepts him. He's friendlier with him than he usually is with servants or soldiers. He seems to take counsel of him, the few times I've seen them together. It's almost funny to watch them together. You'd think Galen was aping Regal from the way he dresses and walks as the prince does. Sometimes they almost look alike.
They do.
Chade leaned closer, waiting.
What else have you noticed?
I searched my memory for more first-hand knowledge of Galen.
That's all, I guess. Has he ever spoken to you?
No.
I see.
Chade nodded as if to himself.
And what do you know of him by reputation? What do you suspect?
He was trying to lead me to some conclusion, but I could not guess what.
He's from Farrow.
An inlander. His family came to Buckkeep with King Shrewd's second queen. I've heard it said that he's afraid of the water, to sail or to swim. Burridge respects him, but doesn't like him. He says he's a man who knows his job and does it. But Burridge can't get along with anyone who mistreats an animal, even if it's out of ignorance. The kitchen folk don't like him. He's always making the younger ones cry. He accuses the girl of getting hair in his meals or having dirty hands. And he says the boys are too rowdy and don't serve food correctly. So the cooks don't like him either, because when the apprentices are upset, they don't do their work well. Chade was still looking at me expectantly, as if waiting for something very important. I racked my brains for other gossip.
He wears a chain with 3 gems set in it.
Queen Desire gave it to him, for some special service he did. The fool hates him. He told me once that if no one else is around, Galen calls him freak and throws things at him.
Chade's brows went up.
The fool talks to you?
His tone was more than incredulous. He sat up in his chair so suddenly that his wine leaped out of his cup and splashed on his knee. He rubbed at it distractedly with his sleeve.
Sometimes, I admitted cautiously.
Not very often. Only when he feels like it. He just appears and tells me things.
Things? What kind of things?
I realized suddenly that I had never recounted to Chade the Fitz-Fitz-Fats riddle. It seemed too complicated to go into just then.
Oh, just odd things. About 2 months ago he stopped me and said the morrow was a poor day to hunt. But it was fine and clear. Burridge got that big buck that day. You remember, it was the same day that we came up on a wolverine. It tore up two of the dogs badly.
As I recall, it nearly got you.
Chade leaned forward, an oddly pleased look on his face.
I shrugged.
Burridge wrote it down, and then he cursed me down as if it were my fault, and told me that he'd have knocked me silly if the beast had hurt Sooty. As if I could have known it would turn toward me. I hesitated.
Chade, I know the fool is strange, but I like it when he comes to talk to me. He speaks in riddles, and he insults me and makes fun of me, and gives himself leave to tell me things he thinks I should do, like wash my hair, or not wear yellow. But...
Yes?
Chade prodded, as if what I was saying was very important.
I like him,
I said lamely.
He mocks me, but from him, it seems a kindness. He makes me feel, well, important. That he could choose me to talk to.
Chade leaned back. He put his hand up to his mouth to cover a smile. But it was a joke I didn't understand.
Trust your instincts,
he told me succinctly,
and keep any counsel the fool gives you.
And as you have,
keep it private, that he comes and speaks to you. Some could take it amiss.
Who?
I demanded.
King Shrewd, perhaps. After all, the fool is his, bought and paid for.
A dozen questions rose to my mind. Chade saw the expression on my face, for he held up a quelling hand.
Not now. That's as much as you need to know right now, in fact, more than you need to know. But I was surprised by your revelation. It's not like me to tell secrets.
Not my own.
If the fool wants you to know more, he can speak for himself. But I seem to recall we were discussing Galen.
I sank back in my chair with a sigh.
Galen.
So he is unpleasant to those who cannot challenge it, dresses well, and eats alone. What else do I need to know, Chade? I've had strict teachers, and I've had unpleasant ones. I think I'll learn to deal with him.
You'd better.
Chade was deadly earnest.
Because he hates you. He hates you more than he loved your father. The depth of emotion he felt for your father unnerved me. No man, not even a prince, merits such blind devotion, especially not so suddenly. And you, he hates, with even more intensity.
It frightens me.
Something in Chade's tone brought a sick chill stalking up from my stomach. I felt an uneasiness that almost made me sick.
How do you know?
I demanded.
Because he told